What current signs are there that the Earth is in the midst of the sixth great mass extinction? What impacts are CO2 having on the Earth's atmosphere and oceans? What evidence is there that geoengineering is playing a role in the California wildfire situation? Could deadly UV radiation entering the Earth's atmosphere through a deteriorating ozone layer trigger the end of all higher life forms on Earth? Are national governments part of the solution or part of the problem in remediating the threats facing human existence? On this week's Global Research News Hour, with a high-level climate change conference now underway in Bonn, Germany, we take a closer look at the threats posed to the environment by human activities and what, if anything, can be done to remedy the situation. We'll hear from investigative journalist and climate change writer Dar Jamail on the current indicators. We'll hear from researcher Dane Wigington on clandestine geoengineering activities, and we'll hear brief excerpts of a conversation with a researcher investigating UV radiation penetration of the ozone layer. On this week's program, clear and present dangers, climate collapse, geoengineering, and the ozone hole. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of November 10th, 2017. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. A new United Nations-sponsored report on the April 4th sarin incident in an al-Qaeda-controlled town in Syria blames Bashar al-Assad's government for the atrocity, but the report contains evidence deep inside its Annex 2 that would prove Assad's innocence. If you read that far, you would find that more than 100 victims of sarin exposure were taken to several area hospitals before the alleged Syrian warplane could have struck the town of Khan Shaykhun. Still, the Joint Investigative Mechanism, or JIM, a joint project of the UN and the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, brushed aside this startling evidence and delivered the Assad guilty verdict that the United States and its allies wanted. The JIM consigned the evidence of a staged atrocity in which al-Qaeda operatives would have used sarin to kill innocent civilians and pin the blame on Assad to a spot 14 pages into the report's Annex 2. The sensitivity of this evidence of a staged attack is heightened by the fact that President Trump rushed to judgment and ordered a retaliatory strike with 59 Tomahawk missiles on a Syrian airbase on the night of April 6th to 7th. That comes from the article, Did Al-Qaeda Dupe Trump on Syrian Attack? By Robert Perry, posted November 10th, originally appearing at Consortium News. GM rice accounted for about a third of contamination cases, despite the fact that there is officially no GM rice grown anywhere in the world. They also focused on cases of contamination arising from unauthorized GM crops, those without any authorization for commercial growing anywhere in the world. 9 cases were discovered of GM contamination of these unauthorized, non-commercialized GM crops that haven't undergone any environmental or food safety analysis. The authors argue that once GM contamination has happened, it can be difficult to contain. Don Westfall, biotech industry consultant and vice president of Promar International back in 2001, was at the time quoted by the Toronto Star on 9th of January 2001 as saying that the hope of the GM industry is that over time the market is so flooded with genetically modified organisms that there's nothing you can do about it. You just sort of surrender. That comes from the article, GM Food Crops Illegally Growing in India, The Criminal Plan to Change the Genetic Core of the Nation's Food System, by Colin Todd Hunter, posted November 10th. NATO needs civilian infrastructure in Europe to meet its growing military requirements, Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said ahead of a meeting in Brussels. This will mean coordination with national governments and the private sector, he added. Defense ministers from the 29 NATO states arrived in Brussels to begin discussions on a revision of the NATO command structure. What is envisioned is a new command to protect sea lines between North America and Europe, and another to, quote, improve the movement of troops and equipment within Europe, unquote. Stoltenberg believes that a revision of NATO's structure is necessary to tackle the alleged threat from Russia. That comes from the article, NATO wants Europe's civilian infrastructure ready for war with Russia, posted November 10th, originally appearing at RT World News. As we reported yesterday, the WSJ writes that the country's central bank, the Saudi Arabian Monetary Authority, said late Tuesday that it has frozen the bank accounts of persons of interest and said the move is, quote, in response to the Attorney General's request pending the legal cases against them, unquote. But what is more notable is that while we first suggested jokingly on Monday that the ulterior Saudi motive would be to simply nationalize the net worth of some of Saudi Arabia's wealthiest individuals, now the WSJ confirms that this is precisely the case. And what's more notably is that the amount in question is absolutely staggering, nearly two times Saudi Arabia's total foreign reserves. As the WSJ alleges, quote, the crackdown could also help replenish state coffers. The government has said that assets accumulated through corruption will become state property, and people familiar with the matter say the government estimates the value of assets it can reclaim at up to 3 trillion Saudi rial, or $800 billion. While much of that money remains abroad and invested in various assets from bronze to stocks to precious metals and real estate, which will complicate efforts to reclaim it, even a portion of that amount would help shore up Saudi Arabia's finances. That comes from the article, Real Motive Behind Saudi Purge Emerges, $800 billion in Confiscated Assets by Zero Hedge, posted November 10th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. The 23rd session of the Conference of the Parties to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change is now underway and is being held in Bonn, Germany, under the presidency of the government of Fiji, one of the small island states threatened by climate change-induced storms and sea level rise. On the agenda for this conference, an intergovernmental dialogue detailing the ways and means to assist all governments, supported by non-party stakeholders, which may better meet the goals of the Paris Agreement now and over the years and decades to come. This year's conference comes in the wake of yet another year of gloomy news of our dire climate predicament. Massive wildfires, floods, intense hurricanes, and other unprecedented weather events are wreaking havoc on the planet and its dominant species, Homo sapiens. Dar Jamail is a staff writer for Truth Out and the author of several books, including the forthcoming The End of Ice from New Books. He is the recipient of the Martha Gellhorn Award for Investigative Journalism, among other awards. He joins us now from Washington State to elaborate a little bit more on the state of abrupt climate disruption on planet Earth. Welcome, Dar.
Thanks, Michael. Good to be with you.
I was wondering if there are any particular developments over the last 12 months that you think really need to be emphasized in terms of waking up the general population to the extreme urgency of taking responsible action, both at the COP conference and beyond. What would you like to highlight?
Yeah, there's so much. I mean, the challenge would be just, not talking about that fact alone for the rest of our time together. But I think, you know, the extreme hurricane season that we saw, you know, Hurricane Harvey, what happened in Houston, the single largest rain event ever recorded in the history of the United States. I mean, there was enough water on the ground in that region during that time that it literally depressed the Earth's crust several millimeters. This is not normal. Another thing that people need to keep in mind is the devastating wildfire season that we again had out here in the West and throughout much of the rest of the United States, where it's on track to be the second largest wildfire season in history, following, I believe, 2012 was the first. So again, note that how close the records being set are to the previous records. Another thing to note is that this August was the second warmest August ever recorded in history, leaving this year on track to be the third warmest year in recorded history. And also bearing in mind that it's 2017 and 16 of the 17 hottest years ever recorded have happened since 2000. And the last thing I think I would point out to people, it hasn't necessarily happened in just the last year, but to note that of all the warming humans have generated, 93% of that has gone into the oceans. So what we're seeing is just 7% of the warming that we've generated in the atmosphere. So it's important to note that the oceans are holding that warming. And this is a very, very significant factor that we can probably come back to a little bit later in our discussion.
For sure. I'm wondering also if you could comment on just the what we've discovered in terms of the loss of species. I mean, not just species, but like actual animal individuals. There's been a large decline that we've seen just in the last few decades.
That's right. There is a normal extinction background rate. It's somewhere between 1% and 2%. We're looking at an average extinction rate now of between 150 and 200 species per day. That puts us somewhere over 1,000 times above the normal background extinction rate. We're looking at losses of wildlife and other species, certainly marine life as well, that are, again, just unprecedented in the history since humans have been on the planet. Another thing that happened actually quite recently was a report came out of Germany showing that a huge number of insects, in fact, 3/4 of their entire flying insect population has disappeared in just recent years. And this is something to take note of, because when we talk about the importance of insects in any ecosystem and the role that they play in fertilization and as a food source for different parts of the food chain, if we lose insects, seemingly insignificant to many people, then we are actually in great jeopardy, because of course our food supply and the food supply of the greater ecosystem is then in very big trouble. So certainly there are alarm bells sounding throughout the insect and animal kingdom, as well as in the oceans, of the impacts of we've now raised the planetary temperature to roughly 1.1 degrees C above pre-industrial baseline temperatures. So that's something important to keep in mind, and also knowing that we haven't yet really begun to feel the real impacts of the totality of just that amount of warming, given that once you introduce CO2 into the atmosphere, there's a 40-year lag before you feel the full effects of that warming. So that's also important to note, that what we're dealing with now is everything that was emitted up to 40 years ago, and we've emitted more CO2 in the last 40 years than the totality before that.
1.5 degrees was supposed to be that barrier beyond which we dare not cross. And so I think we're on track to go way beyond that. Could you comment on the what's happening at the in the Arctic and the Antarctic?
Well, I just spent a significant amount of time up in Alaska over the last couple of summers doing research for the book that I'm working on. And my most recent trip, I went up to Utqiagvik, formerly known as Barrow. It's the northernmost point in Alaska, and it's a significant place for a lot of reasons. One, because it very much is on the front lines of climate disruption, because the permafrost is thawing, as you in Canada are acutely aware of also, across broad swaths of area. And this is causing all kinds of problems for the villagers there because they're living on top of it. So literally the infrastructure that they depend on is now becoming destabilized, coupled with as the Arctic sea ice is, summer sea ice is retreating, it's enabling bigger storms and bigger wave action on the coast. And so erosion is a very real problem, coupled with thawing permafrost. And because of this, there's over 30 villages in Alaska alone that are going to have to be moved flat out, no question about it. And Utqiagvik, being the largest population center on the North Slope of Alaska, in the seat of the borough there, it's going to have to be moved. Not as soon as some of the others, but what I saw was when I was there is they're already basically having to maintain a giant dirt berm on the north side of the town, right on the edge of the Arctic Ocean, and it's consistently being eroded away by storm action and wave action on it, to the tune where that part of the coast is actually losing 10 feet of coast every year. So at that rate, just from what I saw, given that some of the town's major infrastructure is probably 80 to 90 feet away from the coast, I think it's safe to say that within 10 years, at least part of that village is going to have to be moved. But then, you know, more broadly, the rate of glacier loss happening even across Alaska is again, you know, every year is somewhere in the top 5 to 10 biggest recession years for some of the monitoring that's going on up there by the U.S. Geological Survey. And then also significantly down in the Antarctic, we're seeing pretty frequent reports now of some of the major glacier systems that are literally becoming unplugged, meaning they were grounded enough in the subsea areas where they dump into the ocean off of the continent. And as those melt away, largely helped along by warming seas from underneath, then it literally is unplugging the glaciers. And so they're starting to flow much faster and release themselves into the ocean. And so all of this together, it means bad news for sea level rise as well. Mm.
There was a major paper in the peer-reviewed proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences of the United States from this past spring. Paul Ehrlich and two other researchers, they used the term biological annihilation in the heading. Are you familiar with that document? Could you comment on its significance?
I am, and I've written about that one, and Ehrlich has also played a role in some of the other papers that have come out over the last few years talking about how we are in the Anthropocene, literally a new era on the planet because humans are having such a giant impact across the planet. And they talk about biological annihilation and use that term, which sounds dramatic, and it is dramatic, but I think it's accurate because, again, if you look at the amount of wildlife being lost and the fact that 90% of all the pelagic fish, the large fish in the oceans are already gone. Well over half the wildlife population is already gone. And you know, some of the things we talked about at the beginning of our conversation, you know, all other impacts to wildlife, you know, and this is happening because of climate disruption impacts, but also human encroachment, loss of habitat, loss of biodiversity. And we are literally killing off species on the planet that we don't even know exist yet. I mean, to, you know, we talk about these extinction rates that we mentioned earlier between 150 and 200 species a day. Some of my book research brought me down to the Amazon. And when I was there, I became aware of a scientific expedition last January where a number of Brazilian scientists were helicoptered into a remote part of the Amazon, and in just 25 days identified more than 80 new species. And that's amazing, but what's also troubling about it is that we're wiping out parts of the Amazon and other tropical forests and other parts of the biosphere, and we're killing off species that we don't even know exist yet. So when it comes, you know, we talk about biological annihilation, and then the threat that that poses to us, ultimately, you know, at some point we're going to need new antibiotics. We're going to need to keep developing new drugs, for example, to stay ahead of diseases as they arise. And yet we're taking out parts of the biosphere that may hold those things that we're going to need. And again, yet we don't even know that they exist yet. So this is another layer to that biological annihilation that is so dangerous, and why it is so important that this is not a sane way to behave with the planet on which we depend.
Yeah, I mean, when you spoke earlier about the oceans and how they were retaining more heat, another thing that's happening with all the CO2 that's being dumped into the atmosphere is that a lot of it's acidifying the oceans, and that's having an impact. And as I understand it, there's parallels with the last great extinction, the Permian extinction of 252 million years ago. So. That's got to be kind of a major beacon call that we should be responding to, no?
Well, that's exactly right, and that's troubling enough on its own. But to take that even a step further, aside from the meteor strike that took out the dinosaurs, every single mass extinction event in the history of Earth was triggered by too much CO2 in the atmosphere. And we are actually injecting more CO2 into the atmosphere faster than occurred during the Permian mass extinction event, because that event took place over 80,000 years. And so for context, we're talking about 250 years. You know, if we assume the Industrial Revolution began in 1750, some people quantify it as starting when agriculture began, but if we're conservative and say 1750, that means in, you know, basically 267 years, we've caused this much change on the planet. And compared to previous mass extinction events, this is, to call it abrupt is to put it mildly.
Now, Dar Jamail, the last time we had this conversation, Barack Obama was president of the United States. And now, of course, Donald Trump is in power, and he's put a lot of people from the fossil fuel sector in positions of power and influence, even in the Environmental Protection Agency, you know, the kind of a fossil fuel fox watching that hen house, and other initiatives, Keystone XL, at pulling out of this the Paris Accord. You know, I mean, in a sense, he's literally throwing fuel on the fire that is global climate change. Are there any significant aspects of what Trump has done and is doing that we really need to be focusing our attention on?
Well, you really lined it out. I mean, you know, appointing Scott Pruitt, former Attorney General for Oklahoma, who sued the EPA half a dozen times. I mean, this is a guy literally tasked with dismantling the EPA. And so by Trump placing him atop that, as he's done with Rick Perry as head of the Interior, Department of Energy, and then Zinke as head of the Department of Interior. I mean, go on down the entire list. He's literally chosen the perfect person to disassemble each of these institutions and place them on top of it. Again, you know, the reports coming out, you know, with Tillerson, you know, basically former head of ExxonMobil as the Secretary of State, in addition to everything you just lined out and what I just added to it, it couldn't be more clear. This is basically a free-for-all for the fossil fuel industry in this country now. And the U.S., as Syria recently signing on to the climate treaty, the U.S. now being the only country on the planet of having that distinction of not being signed on to the Paris Accords. And so it's pathetic, it's terrifying, it's maddening, but this is basically a mad dog administration that is, you know, it's basically death throes of the empire. We're gonna try to gobble up as much as we can on the way out is what's happening. And if you look at it through the lens of what's happening to the planet through with the climate, It is worst case scenario. I mean, this is a time where, as bad as the Trump administration is and horrendous in all the ways we just outlined for the climate, we need to be having literally the polar opposite response if we were going to have any hope just in mitigating what's already going to be happening. I think even the general discussion has long since accepted that there's no stopping it. And that's pretty shocking that even in the mainstream, we're at that point where the average person understands there's no stopping this situation. The best hope is how much can we mitigate it? But now looking at the U.S. being one of the not just largest CO2 emitters on the planet, but the role that we play in promoting fossil fuel development around the planet, and being in cahoots with Russia, et cetera, this does not bode well.
I know that over the years that I've been a political watcher and hosting programs like this one, I've developed, a certain amount of cynicism about a lot of the activities of elected politicians, or at least the political system at large, regardless of the earnestness of the individual representatives. And I tend to think that if it's not making money for certain powerful people, your political initiative isn't going to, that's pretty much the main driver of the system, not people lobbying their member of parliament or their member of Congress or whatever. So, taking that to the COP conference, even though you have individuals out there and as a part of a counter delegation in the United States, a U.S. counter delegation, I believe, California Governor Jerry Brown is there, and other people who are trying to, who are basically saying that we're going to continue engaging at the city and state level, and so on. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are about people who really want to take some meaningful action, where they should be centering their attention. Does it make sense to engage these representatives, or should we be more focused on just, building an alternative, community gardens or what have you? Where do you sit on that? Where can you get the most bang for your ecological buck, if I could put it that way?
Well, I think you really just hit the nail on the head. I think that if you really want to enact something tangible that you can see have some immediate benefits, certainly in the United States now with this so-called administration, the only solutions are going to be on a local level. And for me personally, locally, I mean literally, what am I doing with my own carbon footprint? What am I doing where I live? What am I doing with how much of my own food am I growing instead of buying? How much do I drive? How much do I fly? I mean, on that level, and then branching out. And, I think if people can bring a few more people into the fold and get them to be really aware of the crisis that we're in and what needs to happen and just start there, I think that's what we can have happen. That's where we can see some results. And then, possibly on a local level, like I live in a small town that's pretty open to making positive changes in these ways, and we're seeing a big expansion of the use of the amount of solar being installed around here, etc. So in that way, locally, there can still be a lot of good things happen. But I think wasting time to try to get someone elected on a federal level in this country that's really going to take this bull by the horns the way it needs to be handled is literally a waste of energy. I mean, I wouldn't dissuade if someone's hell bent on trying to go after, the corrupt politicians and expose them and kind of take some activism in that way. I applaud that. I'm certainly not going to try to dissuade anyone from doing that. But I think for positive results on a local level, it's pretty easy to find them and it's pretty easy to enact them. And I think that, we have to do that, at least me personally. Otherwise, I get completely dispirited given everything that we've just discussed.
Darje Mail, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
We've been speaking with Darje Mail. He is an investigative journalist, an award-winning investigative journalist. His regular climate dispatches appear at truthout.org. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. One component of the puzzle of weather weirdness affecting the globe is geoengineering. Last month, representatives of U.S.-based groups seeking to put a halt to suspected geoengineering programs filed a lawsuit against the Department of Commerce, which oversees the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, for what they claim are the failure of the NOAA to respond to freedom of information requests regarding past and ongoing weather modification activities. My next guest has devoted thousands of hours researching, documenting, and alerting the general public to these programs, which officialdom refuses to acknowledge. His name is Dane Wigington. He's the lead researcher for www.geoengineeringwatch.org and has investigated all levels of geoengineering, from stratospheric aerosol geoengineering to solar radiation management to ionosphere heater facilities like HARP. He is a past guest of this program and joins us now from his off-grid home in Shasta County, California. Welcome back to the program, Dane.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you for all your work at Global Research and for your group's continued focus on the critical climate engineering issue.
It's been a while since we had you on the show. Lots to discuss. Perhaps we should start with this lawsuit. Is this the first time you've launched a legal action against the government with regard to the geoengineering issue?
Well, there's a part of our legal effort in Canada. We filed there in February of last year. That suit is still ongoing, although getting great resistance from the Canadian government, of course. And here, this is the first legal action taken in the U.S. that I'm aware of. And this is simply a step toward a larger legal action. But what we're getting from organizations like NOAA, a complete stonewalling. And in fact, their response to our Freedom of Information Act request on any information with any weather modification programs was basically a paragraph that said, we don't know anything about any weather modification ever in the U.S., which is completely absurd because they're required to sign off on several hundred state and regional smaller scale weather modification programs every single year. They're on every federal document we have, and they deny that. So this is clearly an all-out effort by the power structure to hide, for obvious reasons, the illegal ongoing global climate engineering operations that have done unimaginable decimation all over the globe, contaminated every breath we take. And really, at this point, Michael, I would argue this point, and I don't think anybody could dispute this, there can be no legitimate discussion about the climate without including climate engineering. And that's something that everybody from every side of the fence should agree on.
Now, Dane, you've documented quite a bit on your website, geoengineeringwatch.org. For curious and skeptical listeners who may need a quick hit, are there one or two key documents in particular that they really need to peruse that should convince them that these activities are indeed happening and not some sort of, you know, groundless conspiracy theory?
Certainly. I would advise two pieces of data to prove beyond any reasonable doubt that these programs are real and ongoing. One, they can search on our site for massive Senate document, or they can search on any search engine, geoengineeringwatch.org, massive Senate document. They can find a 750-page Senate document with the most key pages exerted and highlighted in that post that prove, beyond any shadow of a doubt, this document was from 1978 that stated the programs had been ongoing at that point for over three decades. It states all the agencies involved. It states that there would be cooperation between otherwise opposing governments, i.e. China, Russia, that they all cooperate on this issue because of the cross-border ramifications. Obviously, you can't just geoengineer over your own country and not have it affect everybody else down the line. So this document also states the need for total immunity for anyone and everyone, total immunity from prosecution for anyone and everyone involved in these programs. It's an extremely damning document. One I would recommend people look at in depth, at least beginning with our excerpts, film footage. When we have film footage of military aircraft and commercial with what can only be considered sprayed aerosol dispersions turning on and off with nozzles visible, end of the argument. There's no speculation here. This is going on. And we have the primary elements named in climate engineering patents showing up in lab tests all over the globe in our air column because it's in the precipitation, starting with aluminum and barium. There's nothing to discuss. This is absolutely going on. And the fact that we live in a world in which the entirety of academia, because they're being threatened or paid to deceive the population to hide this issue, it's truly astounding we live in such an Orwellian world when this elephant in the room can be going on in our skies, blotting out the sun, because we have global dimming. Michael, you know what, you've heard the term global
Absolutely,
dimming?
Absolutely, yes.
Sure. So I know you're very familiar with this issue as well. So when we have global dimming at 20 to 30%, the express goal of solar radiation management, I mean, there is so much documentation, film footage to corroborate this. We have photographs of the nozzles mounted on commercial aircraft, nozzles mounted on the pylons, aimed into the exhaust jet stream to make this look like quote-unquote condensation. So bottom line, from government documents, of which there's many, I named one, to film footage, to mountains of other corroborating documents and data, there's no question this is going on.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I just looking up at the sky on a couple of bright, clear days, and I saw these trails that they look like a tic-tac-toe board. And I'm wondering, is that interesting little that those flight plans would align just that way? So, I mean, it kind of makes me wonder, you know. But just to kind of, you know, maybe putting forward a bit of a skeptical point, if I could, when you talk about global dimming, I mean, there are other pollution sources on the planet.
Certainly. I don't mean to negate those. I mean, any form of particulate pollution is going to add to the global dimming equation, no question. I definitely don't want to paint it this or that. There's many, many factors affecting our environment, our climate, but mathematically speaking, the single greatest factor is the intentional climate intervention programs. And we can correlate this with our solar power uptake, which is what got me onto this issue. That's my background with Bechtel Power. I have a large off-grid home, and that's what alerted me to this issue. I was losing tremendous amounts of my solar PV uptake from strictly whatever the aircraft were emitting, and I mean 60, 70, 80% on some days. So when you consider an 80% decline from a sky or solar power uptake from a sky that's completely obscured from no natural cloud cover whatsoever, that's a profound amount of incoming solar UV or solar thermal energy to block. That's a profound amount. So the ability to block the sun to an immense degree is absolutely difficult to comprehend, and it takes a tremendous amount of materials to do that. And we know from the world's most recognized geoengineers like Dr. David Keith, who's been on the Colbert Report and many other programs, he's the face of geoengineering for the power structure, stating their annual goal of putting 20 million tons of aluminum into the atmosphere every single year. And your listeners can look that up, Michael. If they search Dane Wigington, David Keith, they can see me confronting Dr. Keith at an international geoengineering conference where, after the symposium he gave proposing putting 20 million tons of aluminum into the atmosphere every single year, I asked him, had any studies been done whatsoever on the toxicological effects, environmental toxicity? He tried to dodge the question by stating, paraphrasing, there's a lot of material in the air already, a little more won't hurt. And when I reiterated my question, that material is not aluminum. You're proposing 20 million tons of aluminum. And he, if you can imagine, from the world's most recognized geoengineer stating, we haven't studied that at all. Could terrible things happen tomorrow? That's about a verbatim of what he said. We don't know. We don't know. Mm. That's the kind of attitude you have with climate engineering, just like you had with the detonation of nuclear bombs. They do it because they can, because the population is not willing to face this issue and stop them.
I want to kind of get back to that. You touched on something I hope to get, you know, get back to in a minute, but I wanted to just sort of move over to the wildfires situation, the drought, and what, you know, some of the thoughts that you've raised about the nature of these wildfires, and you know, what leads you to believe that there's more to this than the normal, say, CO2 driven climate changes that that we would expect under existing models. I mean, what are there telltale signs that there's some geoengineering fallout, you know, literally or figuratively speaking, that's contributing to these, you know, the wildfires and other phenomena?
I would argue not just telltale signs, but inarguable proof of the connection. And if your listeners search engineered drought catastrophe, target California, they'll find that for a number of years at geoengineeringwatch.org, we've been documenting with satellite imagery the ongoing aerosol spraying assault that helps in conjunction with the ionosphere heaters like HARP. Most of your listeners probably know what that is, but those are massively powerful ground-based radio frequency microwave transmitters that can and do heat the ionosphere, creating high-pressure zones like the ridiculously resilient ridge. That's the meteorological term coined for the ridge that's been parked over the U.S. West for 10 years almost consistently, which blocks incoming precipitation. There's a number of reasons we feel they're doing this. I can go into that in more detail in a moment, but also, off the coast, in the eastern Pacific, which is off the U.S. west coast, we have satellite imagery of blanket grid pattern aerosol spraying almost constantly, which prohibits the normal low-pressure storm circulations from forming that then butt up against the ridge of high pressure anyway, and it keeps the precipitation from flowing inland. And in regards to the drought-causing capability of climate engineering, it's not just us saying this. We have countries in the Middle East, and I'll leave this back into California in a moment, but countries stating on the floor of the UN, the United Nations, that their country is being droughted out by NATO climate modification programs, like the leader of Iran on the floor of the UN. Your listeners can look this up online. They have sophisticated technology, radar, military. They know what's happening in airspace around them. And every one of the Middle Eastern countries that's been destabilized and toppled by the U.S. since 9/11 underwent a once-in-1,000-year drought. Is that a coincidence? I think not. In the case of California, we can see on satellite the aerosol operations happening off the coast that we know prohibit, they alter convection so it completely disrupts the normal hydrological cycle. And we have satellite imagery of that happening day in, day out. So we know this is a cause and effect scenario. There's no question. So in the fires, they've disrupted the hydrological cycle. And in fact, even though we had rain last year, Michael, you know how much they hyped up the rain in California last year, right? Or during last winter. But we've had the longest, driest, hottest period on record since then. We had an unimaginably hot, dry summer. Fuel moistures here are at all-time record lows in spite of the rain last year. We have geoengineering and the aerosol spraying I've spoke about. It ionizes the atmosphere, which makes it more electrically conductive. Thus, in the case of fires in general, like we've had on the West Coast, there's more dry lightning. We have, and this is another important aspect that people need to understand, it's an existential threat. Geoengineering is destroying the ozone layer. So that intense UV radiation is frying the trees in California, frying the foliage, frying the grass, makes everything unimaginably dry and flammable. We have an incendiary dust from climate engineering. That's inarguable because we have a lab test to prove it. Aluminum is an incendiary, so is barium, and when it's in dust form, that's coating the foliage. We have this same toxic metal in the rain that's been happening for overall on the planet for 7 decades, but very heavily since the year 2000 along the West Coast. And that saturates soils, killing the trees from the roots up. So from every direction, climate engineering is inarguably set the template for those fires to be as cataclysmic as they were. And even down to the surface winds that occurred that night, when climate engineering can so radically affect convection, that affects winds, which means they can control creating such a wind event as that which happened. So, again, we cannot disconnect climate engineering with the ongoing global firestorm cataclysms. It must be considered a part of the equation.
There's a phenomenon that I've heard you refer to as a chemical ice nucleation. Now, like, what is that, and how is it being used?
In summary, with chemical ice nucleation for weather modification, that's patented technologies, the climate engineers can and are creating and engineering snowstorms. They're engineering winter. And for those who doubt this can be done, we even had Popular Science and Fox News cover the Chinese government's former open announcement that they were doing this process in China. Obviously, if the Chinese can do it, we can certainly do it. And your listeners can look this up online. If they search Fox News, Chinese scientists create engineer snowstorm, they'll find, again, Fox News and Popular Science. These are endothermic reacting materials that are sprayed into cloud moisture, water vapor rivers that chemically nucleate and form ice and absorb energy. And for those that are unfamiliar with these processes, we have lab tests at geoengineeringwatch.org. If they search geoengineeringwatch.org, chemical ice nucleation, they'll find a number of posts and articles with lab tests where a vessel of water has a few drops of biological and chemical nucleators added. It freezes that vessel instantly. So for people that really, Michael, for those who have a cold pack on their shelf somewhere in a first aid kit, you know you can mix those chemicals together, you have ice instantly.
Right, yeah.
Those who don't realize these technologies exist, they need to consider those basics. So on a massive scale, we have the chemical ice nucleating engineered events that are really the core cause of the massive weather whiplash. That's an important term, an important concept people need to remember. And Michael, you certainly have seen this happening not just in our country but elsewhere, these radical, radical temperature swings in the course of a day or less sometimes. You've watched this, correct?
Yeah, from heat to snow kind of thing?
Correct. And so to give specific examples, one I often use in Amarillo, Texas, May 1st, 2013, it was an all-time record high of 100 degrees on the ground. Official reading was 99, but ground readings were over 100. It snowed the next day. Now, we had, in the last 2 weeks in Texas, we've had parts of the state go from pushing 90 to snow in the northern part of the state, back up to pushing 100 in the upper 90s, back to snow. People should know this is absolutely not natural. And here's what we see. The chemical ice nucleation process creates a cold, dense layer of air that descends to the ground. Cold air is heavy. So we have a shallow layer of air at the ground that is much colder than the elevation higher up. In fact, we just got reports from pilots. They were seeing temperature changes of 25 to 30 degrees escalation at only 3,000 feet off the ground. How could you possibly have a 30-degree temperature rise 3,000 feet up? That's backwards. And we have pilots reporting to us right now that all they are seeing at altitude exclusively is positive temperature anomalies. It's hotter than it should be, far hotter. And that's all they see. They see nothing below normal anywhere they fly. And they're communicating directly with us. Gulfstream pilots, private pilots, some who fly very important people are communicating with us. We also have airline pilots communicating with us, and that's all they are seeing is positive temperature anomalies. So this is an attempt to confuse and divide the population as to the true state of the climate, and the engineered winter events are a part of that process. And Michael, have you noticed that a lot of the weathermen now, we don't really hear them referring to snow being at a certain elevation. It's just going to snow in a certain region, and you have the warm side of a winter storm and the cold side of a winter storm. Have you heard them refer to these terms?
Yeah, that sounds kind of familiar.
If those who watch Weather Channel will see this often. So instead of them saying snow elevations at such and such, you're either on the snowy side of the storm or the warm side of the storm. Since when do you have a winter storm with a warm and cold side? Remember, Michael, when Hurricane Sandy came in, it actually created snow further inland? Do you remember that?
I can't honestly say that.
It did.
Okay.
So think of a tropical hurricane creating snow. How does that happen? And many have reported they notice the different characteristics of the snow because it's not...
So you're saying the terminology has changed in recent years.
They make it up as they go, quite literally. They make it up as they go, just like they've named about a dozen and a half new cloud formations, as if those never existed before, nobody noticed them. So as climate engineering is altering the atmosphere, they just put a name on it, and now it's...
Yeah. Could you comment a little bit more on you mentioned right at the outset of the failure to respond to these FOIA requests, but, you know, other ways in which the, people, these, authorities are suppressing these, this knowledge that you're putting forward?
Well, let's look at the state of California, who stopped testing for aluminum drinking water in 2002. Why would they do that? Let's look at particle testing. Air quality testing generally tests for PM10, 10 microns. Occasionally, they test for PM2.5. The smaller the particle, the more harmful it is. So none of their testing equipment is even capable of detecting this mountain of toxic metals that are floating down on us, which are nanoparticles. So they know this, and I've had a high-level meeting at in Sacramento with five top EPA people, closed-door meeting arranged by a congressional rep, where they told me, to my face, the system is rigged. We're told to test for combustion particulates only of a particle size that's far bigger than what we know is in the atmosphere, and the rest of the sample goes out the window, literally. They throw it away. They discard it. If we look at, I spoke in front of the California Energy Commission in 2009 with their top scientist. I presented data to their top scientist there. At that commission, the State Energy Commission authorized the purchase of a $200,000 spectrometer, which could determine the chemical composition and origin of these particulates in the atmosphere. That $200,000 unit has never been seen or heard from since that meeting. It's been rat-holed somewhere. So there's a very concerted effort to make sure this issue does not come to light. I've had private meetings with Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom in his office in the state capitol with his top aide. They acknowledged the data we presented. They could not dispute its authenticity, and yet they do nothing but try to hide this issue because their paychecks and pensions and perhaps much more depends on them hiding this issue. So what I would stress to listeners, again, this is not just another environmental issue. If we can't breathe without sucking in these materials, which we are all inhaling, we're all absorbing, it's being absorbed in the entire web of life, again, destroying the ozone layer. We have a NASA technician working with us right now, former NASA contract technician who metered ozone for NASA. And right now he's seeing depletion of what he estimates to be 75% ozone depletion in many areas. We're getting UVC on the surface. That's the last band of UV radiation before X-rays. It's a DNA-damaging band. Mathematically, he gives us less than 10 years till total ozone layer collapse. Game over. So what I'm saying is from countless directions, climate engineering must be considered an existential threat to us all.
What do you make of some of the public statements that are debating whether or not geoengineering should be undertaken without acknowledging that it's been happening for 70 years or more, as you claim?
That's a total theater of mass deception. And it's interesting you would ask about that because we had House committee hearings on this yesterday with the usual cast of disinformation people present. And I'll have a post up on that with the contacts for those people later in the day-to-day with the full video of the testimony. And this is nothing short of orchestrated mass public deception. Those in academia who are paid to pretend that climate engineering is only a proposal. And such people, I would argue, should be held, when we expose this issue, they should be held legally and morally accountable by a justifiably enraged population that understands that these people are literally helping to hide power structure crimes of not just genocide or ecocide, but omnicide. And so in our post, the contacts for these individuals who are acting in these massive plays of deception in House committee hearings, pretending climate engineering is just a proposal, they should be contacted by everyone of the public who's willing to help us in this battle and told, we know you know this is going on, and we will hold you legally and morally accountable once these crimes are exposed. So I would encourage people to consider that we have to shine the light on the individuals that are helping to carry out this mass public deception because they are no less than accomplices in the crime of criminal climate engineering.
I guess I only have time for one more question. Basically, I'm wondering if you could address the question of strategic mistakes for those people who have been, you know, I guess you'd say woken up to the reality of this phenomenon. Do you see them making certain mistakes over and over again that are counterproductive?
Yes, and I would start with this. Use the science terms. The chemtrails term is extremely counterproductive to our cause. I realize it's a term some people like, it's descriptive, it seems accurate, but there's no scientific basis to that term whatsoever. So when you introduce that term to someone and they go to search it online, all they find is conspiracy theory and hoax. In fact, even in a currently running FedEx commercial, there's a conspiracy bookstore in that commercial. In the background, there's a big conspiracy or chemtrails conspiracy theory, you know, public programming message. You know, that's one of the, again, your listeners might have seen that commercial. It's running right now. So that's a term that's used to marginalize this issue. If you use the climate science terms, you use climate engineering, geoengineering, solar radiation management, use the science terms, pass on credible data. On the homepage of geoengineeringwatch.org, there's free downloadable files, So anyone, anywhere can print what we've already prepared, a 20-page full-color glossy booklet that you can share just the link for that. You don't even need to print or purchase anything in your own area or use our files to print anything. You can just use our link. It's filled with inarguable photos and data, like the gag order on all the National Weather Service and NOAA employees, the document I spoke about, the 750-page Senate document, photographs of the nozzles. Share those with agencies, individuals, groups who would care if they saw credible data and were given the science terms. So in order to gain traction in this battle, we must do it effectively with credible data. That's what I would argue needs to be considered in sharing this issue, not just pointing at the sky, ranting, and using the non-science terms.
Okay. Well, I got to leave it there, but I want to thank you very much for spending the time to elaborate on this issue with our listeners.
Thank you for your work at Global Research and for your continued focus on this issue, Michael.
We've been speaking with Dane Wigington. He is the lead researcher for geoengineeringwatch.org. And he is spoke to us from his off-grid home in Shasta County, California. There was mention in that last interview about deadly UV radiation entering the Earth's upper atmosphere, resulting in damage to living organisms on Earth. We'll close the show with part of an interview for the CKUW program, Where Angels Fear to Tread, that this broadcaster conducted on October 14th with a researcher formerly contracted by NASA. He has, since February of 2017, been monitoring dangerous UV radiation reaching the Earth's surface. Here are excerpts from that interview.
Intense UVB recently has been an issue with some of the photosynthesis process in plant life. But as far as humans go, it's the UVC region, and in specific, the 270 nanometer. And this is what I focused my study on, 270 nanometers, because it is resonant with all DNA RNA. In other words, it's like a tuning fork at those frequencies. You hit that tuning fork with a certain intensity, and if that tuning fork is at the same frequency as your DNA RNA, it literally vibrates the chains apart, causing DNA damage. The bottom of my green on the charts, on the surface plots, the bottom of the green represents that 0.8 microwatts per square centimeter, which is the maximum industry standard for radiation exposure at that frequency. Well, I've had peaks up to 1.7. And what this means basically is if you go out into the sun, say we're at 1 microwatt. At 1 microwatt worth of radiation, you can withstand about 37 minutes of solar radiation before you're going to incur damage. And in the old days when we had a healthy ozone layer, you know, you go into the sun, you get hot, and then you go into the shade and cool off a little bit and then back into the sun. Well, if you've been into the sun for 40 minutes, you go into the shade to cool off. If you go back into the sun, the damage you get to your DNA is going to be exponentially higher because your body has not had the chance to heal from the first radiation exposure.
The website for Ray, the researcher you just heard, can be found at the URL irawi2017.wixsite.com/sacredseeds. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com.